All right, well, good afternoon or good evening, wherever you're at. So happy to see you here this evening, and was really looking forward to this master class. So, once again, welcome to the month's DMSE master class. This exclusive monthly class is really specially curated for current DMSE students and faculty and individuals who are interested in the esteemed Doctor of Medical Science program at the Arizona School of Health Science, A.T. Still University. And here now for almost a year, we've had the incredible opportunity to learn from and be inspired by esteemed masters in the PA profession and influential healthcare professionals who have made a real tangible difference in their practice and in their profession. So before we dive into today's session, please take care of a few housekeeping matters. Please remember to keep your microphones on mute. If you have any comments or questions, use the chat session. Towards the end of the discussion, we'll open the floor for questions and you can unmute yourself to participate. But let's take a moment to introduce our guest for today, Teresa Holler, MS-PhD. She's the owner of Victory Health, PLLC, a family practice in Wilmington, North Carolina, and an accomplished former assistant professor of medicine at Jefferson College of Health Sciences. Teresa is also a prolific author, having written books like Cardiology Essentials, Holler for Your Health, and On Medicine and Miracles. Her expertise has garnered attention from NPR, Fox TV, Good Morning Arizona, Advance for Physician Assistants, and more. And Teresa is a passionate advocate for patients and practitioners alike, and really offering a ray of hope to those who have exhausted various treatment options in the past. So, welcome, Teresa.
Thank you, Randy. It's a pleasure to be here. Good to see you all.
Absolutely. I have to say, I first met Teresa. It's been a number of years ago now. I don't want to count how far back, but she actually was in a class that I taught at Nova Southeastern on environmental medicine, occupational medicine, things like that. We can talk more about that later, but just a wonderful opportunity. But let's dive right into it. So Teresa, starting with your educational journey, you graduated with a Bachelor's of Science in PA Studies from Touro College, Dix Hills, New York in 1996. Could you share with us how you came to the decision of becoming a PA and your initial experiences in practice?
Yeah, so I had gotten a bachelor's in science in biology first. And so I was in the pre-medical program, and I was applying to medical schools. The summer before I was supposed to have all of my applications in, I worked in a hospital, and one of the nurses in the ER mentioned physician assistant as a field, and I had never heard of it. And so back then there was no internet, so I went to the library in the hospital and I found a book, and there were 14 programs listed in the country at that time. And when I read the description, I thought, oh my gosh, that's what I want to be. That's exactly right. Because being a female, I knew that I wanted to have a family. And I was really concerned about racking up really high student loans at medical school and then maybe perhaps wanting to work part-time. How do I juggle that in the future? So I thought the PA sounded like a better road for me.
Yeah, fascinating. How many times have we heard similar stories from our colleagues, who hadn't even heard about the PA program, and a nurse colleague or a physician colleague said, "Hey, look at this new profession," So,
My health professions advisor, my pre-med advisor, he was the dean of the whole program. He had never heard of it. And my mother, who was an RN, her comment was, be a doctor or be a nurse. What is this garbage in the middle? Yep, that's where I landed.
And here we are 50 years later. Yep,
Yeah.
absolutely. Well, yeah, that's fascinating. Yep. So moving forward, in 1999, you earned your Master's of Science in Medical Science with an emphasis in rural health, rural primary care at Alderson Broaddus College in West Virginia. What influenced you to pursue that specific path?
Yeah, so I was a National Health Service Corps scholar. So I left New York City because I didn't want to go urban, and I ended up in rural North Carolina. And I really loved the idea of making sure that I, like, because the buck stops there in rural medicine, you really have to know everything. I wanted to make sure that I knew as much as I could to help people. And so I thought that would be a good path. So when I was looking at master's programs, that's the one that really intrigued me the most. And I loved going to West Virginia on the weekends and mountain biking. And it's just a really adventurous area. So I enjoyed it.
Excellent. So it's also impressive to see the impact that academia has had on your career. What drew you into education and what continues to motivate you even today?
I just love to teach. And I really love taking really complex concepts and boiling them down into very practical, easy to comprehend steps. When I was in PA school, there was a woman in my class who had five children, and God bless her. I don't know how you can go through the PA program with five children, but she did. And she was failing out. And so I taught her or tutored her in biochemistry because I just really love biochemistry. And I can see the way things work and it makes sense to me. And so that was really rewarding because she had spent a lot of money to be there. And it really would have impacted her family in a negative way if she couldn't have come out with a degree. And so to be able to explain stuff to her and see her mind expand and grasp it, I just really enjoy that.
Wow, excellent. I'd like to touch a little bit on your role as the founder and owner of CME Opportunities, which from what, 2004 to 2006, which was a provider of continuing medical education, speaking of teaching, courses to PAs and NPs. Tell us a little bit about what you were doing with that initiative.
Yeah, I think it's part about being a pioneer in the PA field. You know, it was such a fledgling field back in the day. And so when I was looking for CME, I was a cardiology PA, and there just wasn't the right tools for learning for me. I didn't want to go and learn about the latest PA catheterization procedures. I wanted stuff that was practical for a PA or a nurse practitioner to learn, but that it was specialty PA and more advanced than maybe primary care cardiology. So I started a CME company and I specialized in cardiology and orthopedics since I had a lot of friends in that field, and I brought in the speakers. I did a lot of the speaking myself. And it was a very profitable thing to do back then. But then I got into academia, and that's when I closed the company and went into a teaching position instead.
All righty. Your accomplishments, as we mentioned earlier, also include being a published author, which is no small thing, by the way. Three textbooks, Cardiology Essentials by Jones and Bartlett, publishers back in 2008. Holler for Your Health by Healthy Harbor Enterprises in 2008, and On Medicine and Miracles. I can't even imagine, you know, just publishing one book, but could you share your experiences and publishing, why you got into that, what led you down that path, and maybe what are your thoughts about future publishing?
Yeah, so first of all, it was a total fluke. I was taking your class, so you inspired me. but what happened was I was taking a medical writing course, and I was taking a environmental health course for my doctoral degree. And I decided right before I left for it was called PIEA back then, I don't know if it still is, but for the conference, I just submitted a query to Jones and Bartlett Publishers about a cardiology textbook, because I was teaching cardiology at the time at Jefferson College of Health Sciences. And so I submitted the query and just left, and really didn't think anything of it. When I came back, the president of the company had reached out himself and said, "We are looking for this exact textbook. We need this." And I was already slated to speak at the American Academy of PAs. And so that gave me the credibility for them to choose me as the author. And so it just happened. It fell into my lap. I had to make all the courseware anyway. So I had all my lectures prepared, and it just became a book. And then your course in environmental health inspired Holler for Your Health, because I was sort of angry at the time. And that's my last name. So I thought, why not? Because I didn't know that chemicals could make people sick. And I felt sort of humbled because, in my role with the National Health Service Corps, mothers would come in with their children, and I arrogantly thought I knew more than them, and they were right. And I felt super humbled and really angry that something was missing from my education. You know, I didn't know anything about chemicals causing illness. I didn't know anything about nutrition. You know, I didn't know any of these things. And so that became the impetus for my second book. And that's when I dropped out of the doctoral program because I was writing books and I couldn't do both and teach and practice clinically. It was too much.
Well, it sounds like being at the right place at the right time with the right information. So yeah, good for you. That's wonderful. So in your career now, who or what has really been the greatest source of inspiration for you in your life and career, and what actions or qualities that they possess?
So it's changed as I've grown. When I first started out, I wanted to help people. And it sounds so naive, but it's the truth. And then as I went through my career, I worked with a cardiologist, Dr. Helak, who was really humble. And I just had, you know, I came from New York, I moved to the South, and I had a temperament that was different than his. We'll just say that. And I just learned a lot by watching how he handled stress and how he handled people that didn't treat him well. And I learned a lot from him. And then later on, being in the South, you know, I ended up becoming a Christian, and that has become a huge factor in my life, is my faith. And so those are the sort of the range of how I grew.
Well, as a successful leader yourself, what do you consider to be the most important attributes of successful leaders in today's world? And obviously, you're speaking to faculty and students of the Doctor of Medical Science program. You know. So what are the important attributes? And furthermore, you know, how do you manage to keep your team motivated and united in the face of so many conflicts and obstacles in healthcare today?
Yeah, there's so much. I mean, owning and administrating a medical practice nowadays is not easy. But I will say that the number one quality, other than obviously integrity, but I consider that just the bottom line, but I would say humility. I think that you have to learn it as you go through life, and you have to be able to learn from anyone. And if you consider yourself to know something, to be above somebody else, to be religious, to be anything like that, you can't learn from other people. And I think that that's going to really stymie your growth. So I would say humility is number one. And then I would say that in the medical field, it's especially important to just remember that individuals matter. I think there's a lot of collective thinking that goes on, and that can harm the one that's in front of you. And I think that treating people as individuals and remembering the golden rule to treat them as you would want to be treated yourself. And, you know, the other thing I learned along the way is I just don't believe that people make up problems. You know, it has happened. I had that happen one time when someone wanted to win a lawsuit and made up symptoms. But in general, I don't want to act as if that's the truth, because what if I'm wrong? You know, I don't want to consider someone a malingerer and then look back one day and say I was their only hope and I didn't trust that they were actually hurting. And I think that there's a humility in knowing that 50 years ago, the things that were considered advances in medicine, we mock them now. And so one day, 50 years from now, we're going to look back and we're going to mock what we think is advanced medicine now. And I think that, you know, hindsight is always 20/20. So to have the humility now to say, you know, maybe there really is a valid something going on with a person, and I don't know what it is, but to take it as truth.
Yeah, well said. And, we'll come back hopefully in the question period and talk more about your experience in owning a practice, because it's such a so many moving parts. But let's shift gears a bit and touch on some professional politic issues. You know, what are your thoughts on optimum team practice, especially considering that Arizona, thanks to Dr. Rockcliffe here and her colleagues in Arizona, recently became the fourth state to make significant changes in legislation aligning with OTP. So your thoughts on that?
First of all, I'd like to thank you for doing that, Melinda, thank you. I didn't know what that was. You mentioned that term to me and I had to go look it up because I hadn't heard of it. But when I looked at it, I got really excited. I was like riled up, like, yes, this is what we need, because I do have my own practice and I do practice independently and I have for many years and I do pay a supervising physician. And I don't call him when I need something, because if I need something, generally I need a specialist. you know, I need, there's a reason that I don't know the answer, and there's somebody who has the answer. And it's not generally someone who does the same thing as me. It's someone who does what we don't do. So I find that that autonomy sounds just so wonderful to me. I think it's where we need to go. Nurse practitioners already have that. You know, they have a board that's made up of nurses versus, you know, doctors like we do. So I love the whole concept. I would love to know what the other three states are other than Arizona that have passed it. And I'm sure North Carolina is probably not one yet. So I'll have to look into that and see. I was really impressed with that.
Yeah. And one of the things that I'm particularly excited about in OTP, and Arizona is one of them, but there are what now, maybe 5 to 8 states who actually have a PA specific regulatory board. And which sort of gets to the point, you know, nurses regulate nurses, doctors regulate doctors. Why don't PAs regulate PAs? And we were lucky, not lucky, we worked hard at it in Arizona to finally get a PA specific regulatory board, 5 PAs, 2 MDs, 2 DOs, and 2 at large people. And so really 50% of the board are made up of PAs, and that makes a huge difference. And there are a number of other, I'm hoping that as part of OTP that that at some point more states, you know, that we will take responsibility for our own regulation. So yeah, good point there. What's your thoughts about the whole name change issue that's been going on the last couple of years?
I think it's funny because it's just funny how as you age, the things that are such priorities to you change. So it used to be, you know, a physician assistant used to be sort of insulting to me back when I was younger and a lot more arrogant. And I still think it's a great idea to not be called that, but it doesn't really harp on me the way it used to back in the day. I really do hate being called a physician's with a high, you know, assistant, because I'm not a physician's assistant, you know, and that mistake was made often. But yeah, you know, a name is a name. I can be called anything. I've been called worse.
Well said.
I still think it's a good idea, though. It's just, you know, there's a lot of other battles to fight, in my opinion, but I'm glad other people are taking on these things.
Now, many of our DMSC students are either already engaged in PA education or aspiring to become, you know, PA educators, or they're interested in moving into or upward in leadership and administrative roles, or even just seeking to enhance their clinical acumen. So what advice would you give to our DMSC students and graduates regarding the future of the profession from your point of view?
I think the future is very bright. I think it's a great field to be in. I think I made the right decision all those years ago when everyone told me it was the wrong decision. I wouldn't want to be a doctor and I wouldn't want to be a nurse. I love being a PA. I love that when you want to change a specialty as a nurse practitioner, you can't do that as easily as you can as a PA. You can go from cardiology to say pulmonology. You can do that in this field. And I just think it's a fabulous opportunity. There's so many opportunities as a PA. It's a great field.
Yeah. So, and I want to leave some time for questions from anybody. So folks be thinking about question. In fact, let me start with one. Teresa, you know, with your demanding schedule, owning a practice and family, what do you do to enjoy life? What's out there that makes you smile?
So I really love to do things that push the fear limits as far as things that are athletic, but push the fear limit. So I love Tough Mudders. I love things like that. I love surfing. But I will say that this year I actually tried out and became an ocean rescue lifeguard because my husband and daughter were doing it. And I didn't want to be left out with her home from college. So I didn't actually sit on the chair because that would have been scary at my age. But I did perform in the lifeguard competition and did that with my husband and daughter. And I was afraid to swim in the ocean when I started. And I just went in every day and swam a few pier lengths out right where they were catching sharks. And I just overcame the fear. And I'm still alive. I have all my limbs. So I really enjoy crazy stuff like that.
Goodness. I don't know what to say about that. Good grief. Well, so exciting. And I guess the point is you have to do, you know, what you enjoy, you know, what you know, I always like to say, do something that keeps your heart pumping. which is probably a good deal. So, well, let me open it up to questions from the folks that are joining us here. And I'm going to pick on Jim because I know him well. And Jim has owned a number of practices and that's similar to what you're doing. Jim, any comments or thoughts?
Yeah. Can everybody hear me?
Yep.
Okay. I do. And I have to say, Teresa, I'm beyond proud to call you a colleague. What you're doing in terms of opening your own practice and all the other things that you've been involved with, there's risk there. And that risk, that's part of being that edge that you enjoy to walk on. But I think there's a tremendous amount of reward that comes from it. But I wonder, so I sold my practices for almost 5 years ago now. And I'm wondering, in the last 5 years, have you seen any major change in terms of the difficulty with managing or owning that practice?
It's night and day more difficult. Night and day. I think on so many levels, first of all, patients have gotten way more difficult because there's just been a lot of fear and panic. And I think that that didn't go away. I think that that's part of why I swam in the ocean. I think fear just became like a malignant disease and I had it too. So that's why I'm like, I'm just going to conquer fear. I'm just going to make that my goal. And I made a list of things I was afraid of and I just started doing them. And I think that, people don't trust practitioners the way they used to. My husband actually made a sign and put in the waiting room that said, Dr. Google does not exist. You know, I feel like we have to prove ourselves. It takes so much time to not just say, this is what needs to be done, but now to explain why, but not just in a simple level. Now you have to disprove everybody else that says something different all over the internet. And it just became very time consuming and more of an embattlement with coming up with a treatment plan. And I think that's hard. It stresses out your staff. Staff, you know, it's hard to get them to want to work. A lot of times, with the kids being home, they need to be home now. And, there's just been a lot of changes in schedules. A lot of people did not go back to work. Once the kids went back to school, they homeschooled or they, it just changed so many things. People don't want to work as long hours. It's just, everything's gotten harder. There's new rules and regulations as far as medical records, as far as I'm a cash-based practice, which has been very helpful. I have been from day one, but I will say that there's different rules as far as presenting a good faith estimate before every visit. So there's just a lot more guidelines nowadays than there were before. So it's very difficult.
Can I ask one other question, please? If you were to give one pearl, because I'm very kind of passionate about getting PAs to go into the primary care sector as opposed to specialty medicine. If you were to give one single pearl, what would that be?
I don't know if you're all going to like it, but I'm going to give it to you. I love primary care, but I think outside the box and I do a lot with functional medicine, with nutrition. I look at toxicities and I believe that if you're going to go into primary care, I really think that a lot of patients are chronic illnesses now. They're long-term illnesses. And if you don't think outside of the box, you're going to get burned out because you're not going to be able to help a lot of those types of patients. Acute medical care, super, you have all the tools for that. But for those people who come in, with multi-system chronic ailments, I think opening up your toolbox, and that's what Dr. Danielson taught me in my environmental health class. It opened up my mind and I was blown away by what I didn't know. And I think if you're going to go into primary care, really look into those things and just keep your mind open.
Great. Thank you.
Well said. Other folks. Yeah, Gregory, or Richard, I mean.
That's okay. Hi, Teresa. Thanks for coming on. I'm up here in Greenville, North Carolina, and I actually have a twin brother who's a nurse practitioner, and he and I work together in an emergency department. But we've considered opening a practice together, but in North Carolina, there are some rules about NPs and PAs working together, which is kind of interesting, but it's tough. But what were some of the biggest hurdles you found of when you started to open a practice?
So I actually hired a nurse practitioner right before COVID hit. And I didn't have any hurdles with that other than I had to find her a different supervising physician to meet with her requirements. But other than that, it wasn't that hard. It's just depending on ownership, you know, she was an employee, so that may be different with what you were looking at. It was so much easier back then. I mean, it was so much easier to start a practice. Maybe when I say it was so much easier, it's because I was ignorant and you just do a lot more when you don't know what you don't know. I mean, really, truly, I think, you know, when you look back now, it seems like, wow, there's so many things I have to do right. And back then, maybe I didn't do them right, but I did them, you know, and I think that sometimes can be helpful. I did work for another practice, a small family practice, and I'm still friends with that practitioner. And she was super organized and gifted administratively, which I am not, which is shocking that I've been doing this because I'm not. She had all of the forms and all of the, you know, the things that you need to do it right. She had them and she allowed me to use them. And so that really, I don't know if I could have done it without her having that in place. I also had a mentor, a friend of mine, who set up the QuickBooks, who was in a different field of business, but she understood business and she set me up. I will tell you, I never advertised a single day in my life. Every single person who came through that door was word of mouth. And I find that that's a good way to start because they trust you. When they come word of mouth, someone else sold you to them. And I think that that just takes away a lot of the burden of people coming in because they're so distrustful. I mean, the fear is just rampant right now, especially directed at medical providers.
Right. Well, thank you for that. Thank you.
Yeah, Joe.
Hey, Teresa, thank you so much for all you've done. Wow, you've got a great background. I'm really interested in the medicine and miracles component. And can you tell me more about what led you to that and some background?
Yeah. So that's the one that I'm the most hesitant to talk about because that one I self-published and I did it because I developed a faith and I was trying to figure out how does faith and medicine go hand in hand? How do they work together? And I saw what I would describe as miracles, but I saw you know, people with herniated discs, when I prayed for them, go back, you know, I had a woman who was scheduled for a massive surgery, who she was a CEO of a major hospital system, and she was waiting for a particular type of surgery that wasn't covered by her insurance. And she waited 6 years and she had an MRI every 6 months while she waited and they finally approved it. And she came to see me as a brand new patient, said, I just don't have peace. And I was like, I don't understand. It's what you've been waiting for. And I was like, well, I don't have anything that can fix that, but I'll pray for you. And I prayed for her. And do you know that her pain went away? So when she got called up for the surgery, that she's like, just do one more MRI, and her herniated disc was gone. So I don't know, you know, I've have stories like that. I you know, how do you incorporate that into good medicine? You know, I'm still going to refer, I'm still going to do the MRIs, I'm still going to do medicine with it. But I was trying to grapple with, you know, how do the two go hand in hand? And that's how that book came about.
Wow, how fascinating. I think Beth, did you just send the link? Oh, that's awesome, because I'm going to get that. And by the way, and so you're in safe territory with me, at least. I'm a senior ordained chaplain for college and hospitals and have read a lot of stuff on this. So that's really sounds fascinating. And I appreciate your work on that, Teresa. That sounds awesome.
I appreciate it. I work with the Billy Graham rapid response team that goes to areas that, like, I was just called up from Maui, but I'm not going because it's just so far. I figured maybe California people should go. but I do that as well. Cause I just really, you know, if you ever done these gift testings to see what your gifts are, I always thought mine would be health and medicine because it's my favorite thing to help in. But my number one gift was actually encouragement. I just love to give people hope. I love to encourage. And so that's kind of how they went hand in hand.
That sounds perfect. I'm also on the Billy Graham rapid response team. And so I may see you on a deployment sometime. So we'll have to, I'll get your email. We'll have to exchange some contact information.
That is the craziest thing. I've never met anyone else that does it. And I never mention it. So it's weird that I even mentioned it.
That's funny that you did. And I haven't been on any deployments yet. I just got it this several months ago. So I've been seeing some of the things. And the Billy Graham Library obviously is incredible and amazing and what they do. So we'll have to I know some of my colleagues might have some questions for you, but I have more questions. I'll send you an email.
Okay, that sounds great. I'd love to
chat with you.
What a small world. That's funny.
That is crazy. That is very, very cool.
Excellent. Other questions?
I have a comment. This is Jim again. So our practice was in an underserved area, and Latino underserved area. And part of our practice, we did pray with our patients when they came in distraught or they came in very ill. And our Spanish was okay, but we had people could interpret for us. And I've seen that miracle again and again in our practice. When we would pray with them, it just made a huge difference at the moment and then in the course of their treatment. So I'm not only a believer, I'm a witness. I've seen it happen. So kudos to you and congratulations to those that do that. It's hard because you don't know, you know, where the legal boundaries are, and we didn't know. I was the first PA to open a practice in Arizona, but we did what we thought was right and we never got in trouble for it. So it really worked out well for us.
So I had a supervising physician who told me that I was going to lose patients if I prayed with people, and he ended up not supervising me anymore because I was just like, well, this is the only way I know how, because there's just times when people need hope and they need help, and my faith is the biggest part of who I am. I didn't have it for nearly 40 years. So, you know, now that I have it, it's just something I love. And I think there's a difference between having faith in a God who loves people and moves powerfully in answer to prayers and having a religious judgmental spirit, which I used to have. So I understand the difference. You know, I was raised Catholic, and I used to be much more of that mindset. So I think that people receive it better when it's, you know, given in love and respecting their wishes and their boundaries. You know, if people don't want to be prayed for, I certainly would never push, and I certainly don't push my beliefs on people. But I will tell you, you want to hear a crazy story, or is that just beyond...
No, go for it.
I tell you a crazy story. This is a crazy story. It's a true story. But I had this patient in her 20s who came in as a new patient and told me she wanted to kill children and chop them up into small pieces. Oh. And when she would walk down the street, mothers with kids would cross the street because they could see on her countenance that there was something very wrong. And so she came to see me about something else, and she mentioned that. And I saw her two or three times, and she said that she had invited this yogi to come to our city and do this big event. And right when that happened, she had asked me some questions. I said, well, I'll tell you what, you know, I'm not going to tell you what to believe. I'm not going to tell, you know, anyone can do that. I said, but why don't you do this? Why don't you just pray and ask God, whoever he is, or she, you know, whatever the highest supreme being is, to show you the truth of who they are. I said, just pray that. Then no one tells you what to believe. Well, she went to this yogi thing and remembered that I said that. And the yogi, the big instructor, he was a famous, you know, he came from another country. And he at the very end said, I want you to call your deity into your third eye. And she had remembered what I said. And she said, oh, yeah, I want the highest, you know, whatever power to show me who you are. Well, she saw Jesus walk into the room in the flesh. And then he said, does anyone want to share? And she just went crazy. And she jumped up and she's like, I saw Jesus. Well, do you know that a third of the room jumped up and said the same thing, that's what they saw. And so I just found that was interesting. Do you know that her countenance shifted at that point in time? She came back in, you know, we fixed her some few things medically that were, you know, abnormal. And she then realized that she was living, her boyfriend that she lived with was a Satanist. And it never occurred to her that could impact her before. But after that encounter, she moved out, her countenance shifted, and now she's, you know, she's happy, healthy, and she doesn't want to kill children. So who knows what could have happened if she didn't come through the door and have an encounter with something powerful that didn't want to hurt people. So I've seen some strange stuff. I've seen some strange stuff.
That's amazing. It sounds like there's another book in the works for a collaboration of authors here, Teresa.
Perhaps.
Jim's smiling. Jim and I have had this discussion in the past.
I have a book. It's not in the works. It's been on my heart for about 2 years, but I just haven't been able to be disciplined enough to sit and do it. So I'm hopeful that will happen.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Teresa, I just wanted to piggyback a little bit on the miracle side of things, but I transitioned recently into neonatology, and I'm one of the first PAs in at Levine Children's here in Charlotte, practicing in the NICU, and I just, it's so humbling, and it is an amazing field to be in, and trying to balance the miracles that we see and the medicine and staying on top of the things that we don't know and the advancements that are needful. We save or we preserve the life of these tiny and tinier and tinier fetuses, which provides just an incredible opportunity to watch what is supposed to be happening within the womb to be happening in front of us. And it is truly an incredible field. But I'm curious, because what you mentioned earlier about just being open to the things that we don't know and the thing, you know, the advancements in medicine that may be laughable later. What sources, when you're trying to be open and invest some time and energy into hopefully helping people with more than what we know or what we think we know, what sources do you go to, or do you have any specific sources that you like to go to help open your mind to maybe more potential options for causes and or treatments of different processes? So,
what a great question. Fabulous. I will say this before I tell you my sources. One of the things that I do that I think is the most important and powerful things that I do is every time I'm talking to a patient and something comes up that I'm like, oh no, this is going to be hard, or this could be a battle with this person, or I don't know what to do, I pray in my head. I just start praying. I'm listening to them. I'm doing my medical differential diagnosis, not like I'm not using my brain, it's on, but I'm also praying at the same time. I'm like, God help me, I don't know what to do. Jesus help you. You know, I'm praying that. And something sometimes will pop in my head and sometimes not, right? But that's what I do. So that's one thing. And then the second thing is when I started kind of looking at what other tools do I need, I started in what's called functional medicine. It's called the IFM, the Institute of Functional Medicine. Dr. Mark Hyman is one of the fathers of the field. Dr. Leo Galland trained him. He's a Harvard trained MD. I worked for Leo Galland, and I spent 3 years editing a drug nutrient supplement database that did interactions between drugs, supplements. And I had to read every single PubMed abstract that had a vitamin in it and then change it into layman's terms and put it in a database for him. And so I got what I call my free doctorate working for this, the guru who started the whole field of functional medicine. And I got paid to read all these journals, and I opened up all these folders on the computer, and I would just catalog stuff. Okay, this one's diabetes, boom, boom, boom. This one's and then that's kind of how I started. But the field of functional medicine is what I call the basic. It's like nutrition, basic how to heal the gut microbiome. You know, you start real simple, then you move into hormones. I don't subscribe to a lot of the hormone stuff. You know, I just believe in natural aging. You know, there's some weird stuff, you know, weird for me, maybe not for someone else, but some people then go up into that level. I also don't overtreat a thyroid. You'll see, you know, when you go into these things and you bring tools, you're going to reject some. And that's what you call, you know, using your brain, but you'll see that. You'll see, you know, I don't think that there's subclinical hypothyroidism. I haven't seen that. What I've seen is you've missed something else. You know, that's what I've seen. And you throw them into AFib when you overtreat it. So what I'm saying is you can start there. The Institute of Functional Medicine is a great stop for you. Working with the babies, MAPS would be fabulous. And they're going to be in Arizona, September 6th through 10th. I'll be speaking. The Medical Academy of Pediatric Special Needs. You'll never meet a finer group of physicians. It's evidence-based medicine. They're very particular about that. Anyway, that's another one that I really like.
I'm sorry, are they specific to a specific age range? Do they include prematurity, the neonatal world specifically?
I think they're going to be looking at the children when they end up in a pediatric practice after they're released. Sure. But I think that, you know, you may be the one who opens up the, you know, who opens up the to others. Like you might be able to come in and expand that.
That'd be great.
So I don't know about the world of neonatology. Again, when you're looking at tools for neonates, for anything that's acute, I consider that acute medicine. I mean, that's as acute as it gets. I think that you have the best tools in conventional medicine. I really do. I think, but that's why I loved cardiology. I had the best tools, right? That's acute. That's, you know, you're going to run a, you know, adenosine drip and you're going to save someone quick from SVT. I mean, like those, you can't beat those tools. So you're in a good field, but I would say looking at other things, MAPS would be a good place to start for you perhaps.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, they are. It's a truly humbling experience to see what little control we have over certain things. And I don't know about anybody else, but in PA school, I had very minimal nutrition classwork. And to be responsible for each individual, to be identifying and every day to be determining how much sodium acetate and how much potassium chloride, you know, any to be manipulating each tiny little bit of nutrition that these babies get, it's pretty intimidating. So I am all about trying to find as much information. And these are people's worlds, right? This is people who don't have faith, people, this is their entire world in an isolate. And so
it's incredible what can be done in the NICU. It's incredible, mind blowing.
So I really appreciate any resources outside of our standard go-tos, because I do think it's just, it's an opportunity to show our greatest love for somebody else's greatest love. But thank you.
Well said. Well said.
Wow. Great, great discussion. Anybody else? Well, Teresa, what's next for you?
So I have been training practitioners over Zoom. I've done over 100 this year already, in exactly what Liz is asking, to, you know, expanding their toolbox. I've been doing that, and I really do have another book in my heart. I just, I've been doing too much surfing and swimming out to the pier, trying not to be afraid of sharks. So I really do need to sit down in the chair and write. So I'm really just waiting for the fall to come, where I don't get distracted by wanting to enjoy the outdoors.
Wonderful. Well, I just want to tell you how exciting it's been tonight to have you here and talk with all of us. Any last minute comments before I wind things up?
No, I'm just really thankful that you asked me here, and what a great team of people you put in front of me. That was really fun. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And we're recording it for those that weren't able to attend, and I'm sure they will enjoy it as well. So, you know, thank you for gracing us with your presence and sharing your insights, you know, in this month's masterclass. And for everybody else, on September 25th, we'll be back with another exciting guest, Dr. Michael Nowak, a PA educator, a CME provider, and a leader in medical missions to Central America. So we hope we'll see all of you, you know, back in September. And so, you know, once again, thank you for joining us this evening. You know, have a wonderful rest of the evening, and just be safe and stay well.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night, everyone.